Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back with another fun-filled episode here for you. We've actually brought back a guest we've had on the show, I think twice before, if I remember correctly. We'll have to verify that with him a little bit later. But we're looking forward to getting an update from him on what he's been up to and some of the interesting projects he's involved with. But before we do that, we have to always get the update of the week from Sam Bradley. Hey, Sam.
Hey there. Well, it's kind of turning to spring, or so it seems, since the snow melted. It was beautiful today, about 66 degrees, and then suddenly the wind came up and it got the sun went away, and it looks like it's going to rain. So that's probably Kyle's fault, and I want to know why, Kyle.
Well, hey, Sam. Sure. Blame it on me. It's all good. Hello, folks out there on Disaster Podcast Land. I'm meteorologist Kyle Nelson. And yes, we had winter weather moving back into Colorado. We had a cold front drop through in the middle of the day today, Sam. So that's why you saw things change from more spring or near summer-like conditions back to a good feel of solid early spring or maybe late winter. Looking at things nationwide, though, weather-wise, I know, Jamie, this was a big topic in the Northeast, big thing in the news that we were talking about is back-to-back-to-back. So that's three nor'easters, those big, powerful, low-pressure systems that run up the East Coast and dump a ton of snow up in your area. Three of them in 10 days. What were some of the impacts that you had there, Jamie?
Well, it was interesting. The first two had a little more impact than the third one. But we had, I guess I got about 6 inches of snow from one of them. We had serious wind damage from another one, from the first one, actually. It caused all the wind damage, shut down all the bridges across the main river here, and basically separated the state of Maryland into two parts. And then the third one kind of skipped past us. We had a little bit of rain and wind and a dusting of snow, and then it kind of veered into the Northeast and really hammered like Massachusetts, Maine, most of New England with significant amounts of snow, wind, storm surge, all the things we were talking about last week when we were talking about the last storm that came through. That counterclockwise rotation of the low pressure system forcing the storm surge onto shore, just like hurricanes do, which are also low pressure systems. So pretty amazing.
Yes. Yeah, indeed they are. And yeah, these big wintertime low pressure systems, really, really powerful, causing both coastal and inland impacts. It really took me by surprise, and I'm sure a lot of folks in the Northeast as well. The state of Vermont actually had a few natural avalanches occur in some of their mountainous areas, which it's something that you don't see very often up in that area unless you get a big amount of snow like they've had recently. But looking
ahead,
they
had one of the I saw a news item about that that brought that to mind. Thanks for reminding me that they had one of them. I think one of the U.S. Army Infantry Mountain Divisions was doing winter training, and a group of their troops got caught in one of the avalanches and were I don't think there were any deaths, but several of them were carried hundreds of yards away from where their camp was.
Yes, yes, yeah. Several small squad was caught and carried there in an avalanche that was apparently human-triggered from what I've seen so far. And that, of course, for anyone who's ever been in that situation, it's a very disempowering experience, you know, being caught and carried by this sliding mass of snow coming down a mountainside. So thankfully, no deaths out of that. But something, it's more on the natural, well, non-natural hazard side tonight, talking about impacts and medicine and things. There was a structural collapse that occurred at Florida International University here just this afternoon, and it was a pedestrian bridge that was being built, collapsed onto some cars underneath, and so that I saw come across the radar here as far as impacts go and things, and we can perhaps touch on that and how all of a sudden we could be the first responder, even though we're not expecting it. But circling quickly back to weather, you know, looking at the next 3 to 7 days or so from the time that we're recording here, it's going to be a busy week of weather across the U.S., everywhere from California with high winds and heavy snow to a low pressure system that's going to develop somewhere over the Oklahoma Panhandle, bring enhanced risk for wildfires with high winds, some severe weather impacts, and heavy rain across the central, south central, and southeast U.S., and then another round of heavy snow impacting from the Ohio River Valley all the way up into the northeast on through the end of the week. So, Jamie, we are at no shortage of winter weather and just weather impacts in general to be talking about here in the near future.
As always, Kyle, it's great to have you touch base with us and just kind of give us the impacts. I'm curious about one thing. I know about the upcoming potential for another nor'easter, but it really apparently depends on the difference between the U.S. and the European model. So first of all, what are the Europeans doing to our weather? And how does this work? I mean, is it basically something a little bit different from everybody, different schools of thought, or are they different algorithms? How does that work?
Jamie, that is the question that has been raging ever since Superstorm, call it Frankenstorm Sandy, right? The American model, the GFS, the Global Forecast System, versus the European model, right? These are two global scale models, so they're forecasting how weather systems move and act globally. And the debate always is, well, is the American model right? Is the European model right? And, you know, those are the two prominent, the flagship models of each nation, if you will. But really what it boils down to is, you know, meteorologists, we look at models for guidance, but we do not treat them as gospel, because we have to also apply our knowledge, our experience, and, you know, some of the local knowledge that we have gained to help to really distill down what those models are telling us and bringing it down to the local level. So I encourage folks here that are listening to this podcast, if you're not a meteorologist, don't get hung up in all the American versus European versus Canadian, all these different models. Focus on the impacts that are slated to occur here in your area. And that's really the takeaway here, is that's what we're going for, is what impacts are going to be expected based on what the models are forecasting. Leave the interpretation of all the computer output to the experts and focus on how you're going to be impacted in your local community.
Well, I guess winter's not over yet, except maybe in Memphis. Dr. Joe, what's it like down there in the South?
Well, thank you, Kyle, for a spectacularly beautiful spring day here in Memphis, although it's supposed to rain again later in the week. But right now it's 71 degrees, sunny, and absolutely beautiful.
Most excellent. We're glad to have you back, Dr. Joe. You've been a busy guy lately, too.
I have been. As a matter of fact, I just got back from Washington, D.C., and, kept expecting that nor'easter to hit in there. But apart from a little cold, it was a beautiful several days in Washington, D.C., so.
Excellent. Well, we have a long-distance call tonight all the way from Costa Rica. Talking to our friend Jason Friesen, who actually started TrekMed and do some really amazing stuff. And I get their little notices and newsletters on email. I'm just fascinated with everything they're doing. So, Jason, we're glad to have you back. First of all, we want to know what the weather's like in Costa Rica. And secondly, maybe since others haven't heard you yet, you might go back and kind of talk about how TrekMedics got started. And then you can tell us about all the wonderful things you've been doing.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sam. I appreciate it. So as for the weather, it's about 85 degrees here and very sunny. We did have strong winds, but those winds were blowing into the ocean to make the surf a whole lot better. So that's been a lot of welcome wind to have. Not bragging, just trying to be objective. But it is great down here in Costa Rica. It's hot. It's the sunny season versus the rainy season. And we've got a lot of exciting things going on with TrekMedics. So to give your listeners a little background, as you mentioned, TrekMedics we are a nonprofit organization, non-governmental organization. And our mission is to improve emergency medical systems in communities with unreliable access to emergency care and transport through innovative mobile phone technologies. And the mobile phone technology, the innovative one that we're referencing in particular is what we call Beacon. Patching platform. And it works, for the sake of being brief, it's very similar to Lyft or Uber, except it's designed for emergency services. So just give you an example of how it would work. In one of the countries we're working in the Dominican Republic, if somebody in the community were to see a car wreck, for example, they would call the local fire department and say, there is a car wreck at the bridge. And whoever answers the phone at the fire station takes that information down and enters it into our platform, and they send it out as a text message to all of the responders in the community who have been trained. So let's say that there are 45 community responders, and they all have mobile phones. So the text message comes to them via SMS or now via mobile application, and it says there is a car wreck at the bridge. Can you help? If the answer is yes, tell us how many minutes it'll take you to get there. So, like I said, we send it out to 45 people. We don't want 45 people showing up at the bridge. So the software Beacon will decide who's closest and most appropriate, and it'll start triaging them. And it'll say, based on the parameters that the dispatcher sets, you know, let's say the dispatcher says, I want 5 responders with at least one vehicle that's appropriate for patient transport. It'll go through as it the software will basically triage the reply as it gets from the different responders, and I'll say, you can go, yes, you over there, you're too far away, we're not going to use you. This other person, we might need you, hold on, let's see if we can find closer people. And once it meets its quota, it closes the incident. And so those people who have been assigned to the incident are then walked through the process. You know, this is everybody who's ever worked in an ambulance will recognize this process. Because we've basically taken the mobile data terminal from your ambulance and put it on a mobile phone. And so it's a 5-step process. And the first step is, can you help? For those people who have been assigned to the incident, the second step is, did you find the patient? The third step is, for the first person to arrives on scene, they get this question, which is, do you need additional resources? And so obviously, if they went out to a car wreck and they thought they were going to find one or two patients, and they now see it's a bus rollover with 15 patients, they then have the opportunity to request more resources. So that's the third step, is do you need additional resources? The fourth step is, are you going to the hospital? And if they say, yes, I'm going to the hospital, they pick which hospital they're going to. They say how many patients they're taking and how long it's going to take them to get there. And then that sends a text message to the hospital that says, for example, here comes Jason. He's got 2 patients. He'll be here in 15 minutes. Here's his phone number if you want to call him ahead of time. And then the last and final step is, did you get to the hospital? So again, process I was using when I worked on the ambulance as a medic, using a mobile data terminal, but we've put it onto a mobile phone. And originally we started with SMS only, but thanks to a grant that we got from a very, very, a fantastic internet technology company called Twilio. We got a grant from them, and now we've built the mobile app. And the mobile app has done wonders for us and for our partners. And I'll just give you an example. In the Dominican Republic, before we had the mobile app, we were spending about $200 to $250 a month on text messages, on SMS. And that was outbound, meaning those were the text messages we were sending to their responders. And they were spending about $100 a month on text messages from their responders to Beacon. Now that we have the mobile application, those costs are down to a little under $2. So this has been fantastic for everybody, and we're very, very grateful to Twilio for it. And it's also helped us to make it a lot easier to start new programs. And since we last spoke, the last time we spoke, we had programs going on in the Dominican Republic and in Tanzania. And now that we've got this mobile app, we haven't even made a public announcement of it yet. But just from word of mouth and, you know, stuff on Facebook and our newsletter, we've already got a lot of people asking, can we start using this? And in the past 2 weeks, we've started programs in Chile, in Argentina, in new communities in the Dominican Republic, and very hopeful to have things going in Costa Rica and Puerto Rico soon. So it's been a really exciting time, and it's going to get more exciting. And I'll be happy to tell you more about that, but I've been talking a lot, so want to stop and pass it back to you if you guys have any questions.
Well, I think Dr. Joe does, and he had a relevant question that he put in the chat room. So, Joe, why don't you run with that?
Well, I just want to know why we're not doing that in the U.S. I mean, it sounds like a phenomenal improvement in efficiency and use of resources. And I don't know, Jason, has that ever been even talked about, using a program like that in the U.S.?
Oh, I think about it all the time. I'd be more than happy to start a program in the United States. And we do have potential programs. You know, there are services agencies out there that have reached out to us, and we're certainly open to it and would love to do it. One of the things that we're looking at in particular, well, there are two things that could make this happen sooner, quite soon. One of them is that we've been discussing with I'm not able to give too many specifics because it's still, you know, it's still in process, but we've been talking with a well-known American take on the opioid epidemic. And as everybody on this phone call knows, there are people in the United States who witness opioid overdoses and are afraid to call 911. And this, if it doesn't lead to fatalities itself, it certainly leads to delays in getting help to the overdose victim. And so one of the things that we're looking at and very, very hopeful to start would be in those communities where there is high aversion to calling 911, or more likely in communities where there aren't enough ambulance resources at all, where we could set up community-based overdose response networks. We wrote a blog about this that was a little tongue-in-cheek called Uberdose, and it was basically Uber for community for overdoses. And the way it would work would be very simple. We would be working with people who are involved in the harm reduction community, you know, like social workers or methadone clinic workers or safe needle exchanges or Narcotics Anonymous survivors or family members of victims, whoever it may be. People who are already involved in the community naloxone training, they would get naloxone, be trained how to use it, and then we would set them up with our software and, you know, give them the app, teach them how to use it, which would take all about 2 minutes to do. And then if they were to witness an overdose, if somebody were to witness an overdose, instead of calling 911, they could call something similar to a poison control number or a suicide prevention hotline or a, you know, domestic violence hotline, one of the many different types of hotlines we already have in the United States. They could call one of those that's dedicated to overdoses. The call taker, dispatcher could take that information of the location of the overdose, send it out to all of the responders in the community who have been trained and are carrying naloxone, and they would be able to respond, administer naloxone, save a life, and potentially, you know, after that, it comes down to local laws. What do? They could refer them, you know, to other social workers. They could take them to the ED, because we all know that, especially with fentanyl these days, there is a much higher chance of rebound toxicity, which was not the case 2 years ago. You know, just a couple years ago, we weren't talking about fentanyl. And treat and release, they had done plenty of studies about paramedics doing treat and release, and they found very few instances of rebound toxicity. That's changing now. So you've got to take that into account. But needless to say, especially in communities that, you know, think about rural or even suburban communities where they've got a huge overdose, opioid epidemic, but there just aren't enough ambulances to get around, this could be really something that would engage the community and save lives. And so that's something we're very hopeful will move forward. And if things keep going the way as well as they've been going in these conversations, it could happen, I would like to say, in the next 3 to 4 months. But there's a lot of other hoops that just, you know, issues we've got to work through. And we'll see. But that would be very exciting.
It's an awesome idea. I'm sure Kyle's wheels are spinning on how he could use this on ski patrol. Resource management isn't something, it's not like the you get dispatched to a yard sale. It's like every, it's a free-for-all. What do you think, Kyle?
Well, it's a, I love it. It's a really innovative method, and it really kind of relies on, you know, that it's really places the onus on the folks that are arriving on the scene, getting the quick size up and being able to, I mean, relay that feedback in real time back to the folks at you know, whether it's their colleagues, whether it's at a fixed dispatch center, something like that. But being able then to apply this, you know, and take this methodology from, you know, a remote or a more desolate area as opposed to an urban setting where, you know, you have, you know, ambulances every couple of blocks, let's say for an example. It's quite similar to how some of some ski patrol operations operate, where, you know, a lot of it is you go there and, you know, you might be a person that calls in, it might be an employee, might be a guest, it may even be a patroller that skis up on it. But then to start the ball rolling and to have that system in place to actually, you know, get the, you know, because ultimately it comes down, you know, you want, you know, the right resources to the right place at the right time for, you know, the best possible outcome. It's like, oh my gosh, you know, this is really what it needs to be. And, you know, for some of these resorts that operate in areas that have very poor cell phone reception and poor communications, it may be, you know, a great way to help to really also empower your other resort employees as well, because each employee that you have, whether it's, you know, a volunteer ski patrol, whether you're a lift operator, lift maintenance, ski school, whatever it might be, to be able to have that availability to go and say, hey, I can contribute to the overall positive outcome of this scene that I just skied up on, that is very empowering. And if we can give folks those tools and, you know, translate that and take that to a larger scale, I think it really helps to build confidence and just build the community at a resort or in a actual, you know, city or a town as well.
There you go, Jason. There's some food for thought for you. I wanted to ask Joe, what do you think about the opioid idea?
Well, I think it's, you know, anything we can do to respond to that crisis makes a lot of sense to me. We're certainly our current system is overwhelmed by those folks. I'll take a little bit of literary license here and just say that, you know, Narcan is hardly the long-term answer to the opioid epidemic. And we're going to have to do a lot more than outfit people with Narcan to ever make much of a long-term dent in the opioid epidemic. But I certainly do support the idea of getting more rescue medications out to where we can get them delivered more quickly in hopes of saving more people.
Yeah, for real. Jamie, thoughts?
Well, I think about the ways that this could be used for so many different things, especially for activating some of those responders that are in specialized roles in the system, perhaps like our, you know, citizen trained responders, like our CERT responders for the disaster level events. Coordinating them, it doesn't make sense to give all of them radios or pagers or anything like that, but they're all going to have a cell phone. So giving them the opportunity to be activated by a single from a single central dispatch center during a major disaster event could pull together resources at the time when first responders are completely overwhelmed. Think about the Cajun Navy. How could this something like this be used within that set of resources to dispatch boats and airboats and things like that to people that are stranded in their homes due to flooding? You start thinking about all the different ways these citizen networks could be activated in much the same way that Jason's been already putting them in place in other countries. I think we get spoiled and get a little bit of tunnel vision in how we look at our system, and we don't often think outside the box and look at the ways we could utilize other resources that are out there. And I think this is a low cost way to put together groups like Team Rubicon. I mean, all those NGOs out there that might be responding to a disaster event like what happened in Houston and Florida and Puerto Rico with the hurricanes could significantly change the way citizens respond to help their neighbors.
So, Jason, we filled your head with a bunch of new ideas. What do you
think? Yeah, so actually, I couldn't have asked for a better segue from both Joe and Jamie, because one, to Joe's point, absolutely right. We're not going to turn the opioid epidemic around by getting more Narcan on the streets. Those are bigger. I look at it the same way as you would look at like ambulances for drunken driving accidents. You know, ambulances aren't there to stop drunk driving, but they are there to make sure to mitigate the fallout from it. And I kind of look at it the same way as Narcan, but those are much more deep-seated issues. However, to Jamie's point, so I couldn't have, again, asked for a better segue here, because just today we got a grant. We knew it was going to come, but today it finally came through from Cisco. And Cisco, as you guys may know, or if your listeners don't, Cisco, they do technology, all sorts of technology, from routers to cables to, you know, chips and all sorts of different things. And we've been talking to them for a long time about getting support from their corporate social responsibility about, you know, to improve our platform Beacon. And as it turns out, we had been talking to them for a while, and they said, we love what you're doing. You're doing emergency response, and that's what we really focus on through our corporate social responsibility is emergency response. But they said the issue is that you guys kind of do day-to-day emergency systems, and we're really focused on disaster response. And so they said, can you use Beacon in a disaster setting? And of course I said, yes, of course you can. But, you know, I needed to prove that point. And so last year during Harvey, I'm on a DMAT team, as I know some of you are as well, as I'm on DMAT California 4. And we were deployed to Houston for Harvey. And so we got there to Dallas before Harvey had made landfall. And, you know, because it's a big federal team as opposed to somebody like Team Rubicon, a big federal. So we were in a hotel waiting for our assignment and, you know, for the first day or two after Harvey had hit. And I'm watching TV about the Cajun Navy and about all these pop-up emerging, you know, these what they call emergent groups of just spontaneous volunteers showing up and saying, how can we help? And, you know, I'm watching all of these swamp boats going around, and these guys are and gals are doing just miraculous, really heroic work, saving people, getting them off the off the roofs, getting them, you know, out of flooded homes, putting them in their personal boats and taking them to safety. And so this is really fascinating for me, because I'm watching and wondering, how in the world are they communicating? And turns out they're using Facebook Messenger, and they're using WhatsApp, and they're using this other app called Zello, which is like a walkie-talkie. And, you know, they're using what they've got at their disposal and putting it together ad hoc. And so and they had also set up websites. Different people had set up websites where, you know, if you need help, just tell us and we'll put your PIN, the PIN of your location, on a map, and then somebody will claim it, and then, you know, like a ticket, and they'll go and try and hunt you down and give you the help you need. And so I'm thinking to myself, what these guys need is an Uber for austere environments, right? They need Beacon. So I started calling these people up while we're waiting to get deployed for the DMAT team. You know, there's some downtime going on. So I start making some phone calls, and I was able to get in touch with people who are running these different sites. And I heard back from some of them, and they said, you know, we wish we would have met you, you know, a couple days ago, because you've got exactly what we need, but the train has already kind of left the station. And so they said, you know, let's talk later, but, you know, it sounds like a great idea, but right now things are already moving. We can't switch horses midstream here. So I said, you know, fair enough. That makes a lot of sense. And after Harvey was then, Irma and Maria and, those communities in the Dominican Republic that were already using the software. And so we got to see it used, you know, to respond and do like community evacuations and flood zones and all that stuff. And it was really, really fulfilling to see it happen. But I'm thinking the whole time, like, the problem here is that I and my staff, we're the bottleneck, right? Like, we're the reason why more people can't use the software more quickly. So what happened was we went to Cisco afterwards and we said, we've got an idea. We know how to make Beacon disaster friendly. And we said, what we want to do is we want to change the registration process and we want to make it so it's basically a do-it-yourself 911 system. And the way it'll work is that interested individuals and volunteers or agencies, whoever it is, can come to our website, sign up for an account, and within 30 minutes, they'll be able to learn how to use Beacon as a responder, but then they'll also have a map editor so that they can set up their own catchment area, edit a map to put in all the pertinent points of interest and the zones and the routes, you know, do this all on a map, then test their catchment center out, and then launch it within 20 minutes, 30 minutes without ever talking to us. So basically a do-it-yourself 911 system. So if the Cajun Navy shows up and somebody knows about our software and platform, they can get an entire call center running in 20 to 30 minutes, no problems, no questions asked. And so Cisco said, that sounds like a fantastic idea. And so, you know, we had to submit the formal proposal and go through the process, work out the details with their staff. They're, you know, very helpful, very well-educated and you know, quite expert staff. And we just got the grant to come through today, and we've started development on this web portal, and we expect it'll be finished in the next 8 to 10 weeks ahead of time of the next hurricane season. And so as a part of this grant, we'll also be working with two other NGOs. One of them is called Impact Northwest, and another is called All Hands. And they do basically disaster response, and they also do capacity building for communities to be better prepared for when disasters hit or long-term recovery and reconstruction. So we'll be working with those two organizations to deploy it, but it's going to be really exciting because we're going to basically have a do-it-yourself 911 system that anybody can use. And the beauty of it is it will have a huge impact for coordinating and dispatching responders in disasters, but it also won't matter if you're not in a disaster zone. If you work for a ski, you know, if you work for a ski rescue, you can go ahead and sign up for this and create your own catchment area for the mountain you work at. If you're a community paramedicine group, if you're an overdose response network, if you're a rural volunteer fire service, anybody who's responding to emergencies in an organized and coordinated way, they can sign up and basically set up their own dispatch center right then and there. So it's going to be exciting and great segue, Jamie. You are reading my mind exactly.
Well, it just makes sense.
There is just no end.
I mean, honestly, Jason, it was a natural leap, and it doesn't surprise me that you got there way before I did, because you've already been talking to Cisco about doing exactly this, and you know, it's needed. We saw that need in Houston and in Florida and in Puerto Rico. And we know, as sure as we're sitting here tonight making this call, that we're going to see it again, if not this season, in one of the upcoming hurricane seasons or during a tornado event or an earthquake or whatever the case may be, and how this could impact things. And I'm sure, you know, Joe, you're thinking the same thing. What this would do to change community response and community reliability and just the ability to withstand and be prepared.
Oh, I completely agree, Jamie. And the ability to integrate all of that into the larger scale sort of more professional level, you know, rescue. If FEMA, for example, had eyes on a system like that and was able to see that kind of stuff in real time, I think it could absolutely accelerate response capability and efficiency of resource usage.
So, Joe, if folks want to find out some of the things you guys are doing, because I know that one of the things that I like most about what you all do is just how you stay on the cutting edge and know about these types of things and innovations that are on the horizon. If someone wants to find out how to bring your cutting edge training and education program into their system so that they can be better prepared for the next disaster that comes along, how can they reach out to you?
Well, we would absolutely love to talk to anybody that's interested in cutting edge approaches and training. They can find us obviously through the Disaster Podcast, but they can also find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook under the same name. And you can also connect with us through our Facebook page for the Disaster Podcast.
Awesome. Jason, where can folks find you if they want to find out more about Trek Medics and maybe contribute in some way or find out how they can follow what you have going on?
Yeah, thank you, Jamie. We can be found at trekmedics.org. That's T-R-E-K medics.org. And if you go there, you can you'll see right on the front page the links to the iTunes App Store and the Google Play Store, where you can download our app for free, register right there, and you'll be in a general pool where we periodically send out simulated alerts so you can play along. But of course, if anybody wants access to the full platform, just send us an email. There's a sign-up sheet right there on the website. Let us know, and we can set you up with an account so you can do the dispatcher side too. But I'd like to say, too, we're also hiring right now. We are looking for a product manager. And a product manager is basically someone who is going to be in charge of the entire platform, because it's starting to get busy on our end. And as you know, the founder and the executive director, my main role is going out and meeting new partners and getting new programs started and trying to raise more funds to keep the software going. And so we're trying to find someone, a product manager, who can basically take over the day-to-day maintenance and development of the software itself. They don't have to have software engineering skills. They don't have to be developers, but they do have to be familiar with how products, technology products are developed. And if they have experience in that realm, and especially I know there are a lot of 911 dispatching folks who've got a lot of experience in this area. And so if we can bring some expertise to the team and have someone take that over or take it off my desk and the other people we've got on our team working on it, that'll free us up to do a whole lot more and just keep the growth going. So if anybody's interested in applying for the job, check out our website and send us a resume and application, cover letter, and we'd love to get in touch.
And while you're at it, on that cover letter, mention you heard about it here on the Disaster Podcast. We've got some amazing people that are part of this community here, Jason, and I wouldn't be surprised if we have a number of people out there that, you know, the little bells going off in their head right now, like this is a tremendous opportunity. And I have to say, having been associated with your organization for many years at this point, you guys do things right. You have your goals and your priorities straight. And I could recommend highly being associated with your organization. So I think it'd be a good step for the right person.
Thank you very much. Absolutely. We would love to hear from anybody in your audience and community who's interested. Absolutely. Because if they're listening to you guys, then they're certainly in line with what we're trying to achieve. And that's really important to us.
Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WXKyleNelson. So feel free to connect with me there and continue the conversation on weather, technology, social media, and the like.
Thanks, Kyle. And Sam, how about you?
Well, I'll be over there with Kyle on all the social medias under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. Certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website and on our Facebook page mentioned. And Jason, I'm not sure if you're hooked up to that, but that would be a great thing if you're not, because you could even, you know, put out your information that you want to get out to folks about your product manager there, and the right person may just be in our community out there. It's what, 600 people, Jamie?
Yeah, just about. And they're pretty active, and they keep in touch with what we're doing and put up comments and questions periodically. So we'd love to have you connect over there. I don't know if you might already be part of the community over there, Jason. I'm not sure, but folks can find it pretty easily. Just go on Facebook, search for Disaster Podcast. You'll find our group. Just request to join, and we'd love to have you be part of the community. We'll happily let you in, and you can start chatting with other folks. You can find me as well over on social media under the handle PodMedic, and I'd love to have you friend or follow me as well. And again, I can't recommend enough to keep in touch and follow what's going on with Trek Medics. They're just an amazing organization. I've been associated with Jason and from near the beginning, I think, Jason, wouldn't you say?
Yes, absolutely. From the very beginning.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I think at one point it was just you, and we kind of caught my radar on the Medic Cast and had you on the show years ago. But it's just been amazing to watch this grow from your vision into what it is today. And, you know, just kudos, dude. That's pretty darn impressive.
Thank you. And thanks to everyone for all your support along the way. And really love checking in with you guys and would love to continue doing so.
Sam, you know, this is just a great example of people innovating and coming up with ways to think outside the box. And the reason for that is just, you know, the difficulty of what we do. It isn't like we're in a well-lit ER room or a surgical suite or something like that. When we have problems in the field, we have to come up with unique ways to solve those problems because we don't always have the plethora of resources we'd have in an ordinary situation.
That's true, and it's because Jason's medic, and it's because he's a D-Medder, and he gets that, and he's found a way to make it work for a lot of communities that don't have anything like that. So, you know, we could safely say, because disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine, that we need stuff like Beacon